You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the New World Pictures Podcast bonus episode. We've got a bonus interview lined up for you. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
This was a super fun interview. I really enjoyed this one.
It is. It's a very good one. And Erica.
Hello.
This is a great interview. We are talking to John Penny, you know, an important filmmaker for us all because, of course, he wrote Return of the Living Dead Part 3, a huge, which we will get into as we start the interview off. We'll talk a little bit about that movie with him. But, of course, we talked to John initially because he was part of the Torment editing team. So we had a whole reunion episode with him and Earl Ghaffari and Scott Alexander, which you can go back and listen to that interview. And so we recorded this around that time. And
I believe people can also listen to our episode about Torment if they do so desire.
Whoa. I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot, Mark.
Are we just going to spend this whole episode telling people what to do? Sit back, relax. There, I'm going to add to it. Relax. And guess what? Actually, hey, also, enjoy.
Enjoy.
Wait, I take that back. Sit up and relax.
Yeah,
sit up. I want you to be full attention on this.
Don't nod off.
Stand up.
Don't nod off. Don't fall asleep.
Stand up, lock your knees, and enjoy.
Yeah, and enjoy. Have a good time. That's a really comfortable position. But not too comfortable that you're going to fall asleep. Just standing up, locked knees, arms crossed. Enjoy. And you're going to enjoy this interview. We talked with John at that time. John also worked, once he finished on Torment, he actually worked on several New World films. So we're going to talk to him a little bit about Body Rock, about Girls Just Want to Have Fun, and also The Stuff. So we're going to talk to him about all those movies, his career there as an assistant editor for New World Pictures. And by the way, in this time that we've, between the interview and now, things have happened for John, including his partnership with Brian Yuzna and their company, Dark Arts Entertainment. They are now distributing films and through MVD, including there's a new 4K edition of Zizek's Road, which John talks to us about in this interview. And so you can buy Zizek's Road. You can go get it right now. Listen to the interview. Enjoy yourself. Have a good time. Pay attention, stand up straight.
And we'll also be talking about that movie when we jump into the Dark Arts podcast.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Everyone get ready for that. That's coming soon.
We have another company. We have another company to talk about now. But John is terrific. He is a great guy. We are just thrilled to talk with him, and he's a wonderful interview. And so here we are talking with John Penny.
Oh, have you seen Society lately?
That's one I have yet to see. That's I've never seen Society, and I really want to see it.
That's Yuzna. It's interesting. I wrote a sequel to that movie.
Oh, really?
We're hopefully going to get it going. I'm in this book
awesome.
Called Untold Horror. Have you seen this book?
No.
Now
I need it.
I'm gonna start shopping now.
When there's no more room in development hell.
That is awesome.
Romero, Landis, Dante, Yuzna, and I wrote this sequel to Reanimator that we were trying to get made, and we have a whole chapter in here, and we have our artwork and.
Nice. Yeah, I had just seen I had seen Reanimator obviously when we were younger and seen that a bunch of times, and then I don't think I'd ever seen the sequel, certainly maybe only the second but not the third. So I got all of them on Blu-ray and I watched the third one, and I just was like, I gotta watch more Brian Yuzna films. I don't know why I haven't.
Part
you know?
Three was where Brian and I met. I went in because I was an editor on the first one, an assistant editor. And then I went in and my agent said, hey, they're doing a sequel. The second one was terrible. But I really knew the mythology because I was there during the shooting of the first one. And my agent said, hey, they're doing a sequel. And I said, well, I have an idea for that. You know, Romeo and Juliet, Sid and Nancy.
Yep.
She's dead. He's alive. And I pitched it. And Brian said, that's the story I want to do. And we worked together, and I wrote the script and associate produced part three. And it was all, as Brian says, it was the first time he never touched a script, you know, because I was really involved, and he was so generous with participation. We became very, very close friends. And we have a company today together called Dark Arts Entertainment, in which we are presenting movies now. We're producers reps. We did Lovecraft's Witch House. It was based on dreams from the Witch House. We did Reborn over here with Julian Richards. I was an executive producer. So as you get long in the tooth in this business, you know, you get sort of moved upstairs, kind of. Right. And I love it, because I'm having a great time, and we're doing some more movies together. So Brian and I have been, you know, we've had a great relationship and a great run of it. We're like family.
Yeah, you can tell that interview between the two of you guys on the Return of the Living Dead 3 disc is really great. You guys are just like so comfortable, and it's so relaxed and so fun to listen to you guys talk about the movie. It's really great. You can tell you have a real bond.
He's been like an older brother to me for so many years, and our families are so close. My daughter just became a doctor.
Congratulations.
I'm very excited. Veterinary medicine, DVM. Mm-hmm. So awesome. It's what her dream was her whole life. And we just had her graduation party at Brian's house, because we're just friends.
I know that we want to talk about some New World Pictures movies, but I do have to say, just to cap off the Return of Living Dead 3. So when that movie came out, I was in my peak of gothdom. And for a movie to have a protagonist who is goth in her apparel, super into body piercing, which everyone was at the time, it was, to me and all my friends, it was like everything came together in that moment. It was all, everything we wanted in a movie right there. So
Brian, you're more than welcome. Brian and I went to Club Fuck in Hollywood to really get into the piercing scene. And you're not, you know, I make wine in Central California as a passion and a hobby. Mm-hmm. We do about 120 cases a year, nice. 2 tons of fruit. So it's a decent project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I've sort of gotten into winemaking a bit. And I was talking to a wine critic in Napa, and he said, well, I lost my virginity to that movie.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay. That's good to know. I may have been an inspiration on some level. I don't know how. She's dead. You know, I'm just saying.
Wow.
That all worked out for him. Yeah, it's fun to hear stories about things. I ran into another fan who had Julie's face beautifully tattooed on his shoulder. And I was just so in awe of it. And then you realize it's not about me, it's about them. How people take movies, and it's more important. It's not more important, but it's like whether or not you created it isn't the issue. It's how they've received it and how much they love it. And that is such a beautiful thing. And I it's a way of knocking your ego down, because it's not really about you. Mm-hmm. The guy didn't really care whether or not I had written the movie or not. He just, no, this is my tattoo, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He owned that movie.
Sure. And he it's on his body. That's how much it meant to him, you know?
Yeah, he owned it.
I mean, it is a compliment to you, but I hear what you're saying, that like he took it, you know, as ownership, so much ownership that it's on his own body. Yeah,
absolutely. And if you can do that, you know, and I was, throughout my career, I've always likened the scripts that I've written like shooting a flare up in the night, and hopefully someone else sees that, you know, that, and they can attach to it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out well for me through the years. To try to bring characters and stories alive that have something, because I always believed in so much in the power of the genre, the engine, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you can do so much with a horror film, and people, you know, the old saying, right? The old saying is that goth people are really nice people pretending to be mean.
And yeah.
Hippies are really mean people pretending to be nice. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that holds true. I've not met a horror fan that hasn't been the most well-adjusted, sweetest, nicest person ever. And I've been around literally around the world with the fans of the genre. And so
I bet.
Been very lucky in that regard. Very lucky.
But so to jump into your New World career.
Yes.
Did that come after you had finished shooting Torment, or was it somewhere in the same time period?
It was exactly the same time period, which is where Scott kind of came in. So I was, you know, I did production on the movie Torment, and then I cut it, a lot of it. And then I started getting a lot of work through Richard Halsey and Lorenzo De Stefano. Now, Richard Halsey, if you look him up, he's a super well-known editor. He did Rocky. He won the Academy Award for Rocky.
Okay.
And he had a deal at the time with New World in which he was like a supervising editor over a number of movies. So the first New World movie I worked on was a movie called Body Rock with
Lorenzo Lamas.
Argate and Lorenzo Lamas. And I came in and I was, you know, basically doing, you know, grunt work in the editing room. And I kind of learned so much from Richard Halsey. He was also cutting, I think, Moscow on the Hudson at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And right. Would invite me into the cutting part of the facility and look at scenes and get my opinion on them. So that was a real huge learning curve for me, being an editor working with Richard Halsey. And the deal was that he would be a supervising editor or something, and then Lorenzo De Stefano would be the guy with mostly the hands-on, and that left me as an assistant to be able to do a lot, which was great fun. So the first movie was Body Rock, and came in and had a great time. And then go ahead.
So you were only on Body Rock just for the editing part of it, right?
Correct.
This is might be where I had gotten a bit confused, because I think Chuck Russell, didn't he work on a little bit on Body Rock? That's where I would have seen his name in the credits.
No, his name was on Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
Well, yes, definitely on that one for sure. I just watched Body Rock again today. So I thought I saw his name there. Now, whether or not, you know,
he may have been a production manager, but I never connected with him.
Okay.
The people I worked with is a guy named Jeff Scheckman. You remember Jeff Scheckman?
He's one of the producer of that movie, isn't he?
And he worked at New World, man. Jeff Scheckman was the guy with the cigar, young guy, but he had a cigar. He always loved the role of it. So he was all over everything. And at the time, New World, when I worked for them, was in Century City. Mm-hmm. Later, they moved to Sepulveda.
Right.
Yeah.
So you got when they bought the facility, when they bought New World from Corman, they rented out his old offices. Corman rented his old offices to them, which they did for a certain period until they got tired of that and didn't want to rent from Corman. So they then moved away to San Vicente, I think. So they
San Vicente is where Corman's version was.
Right. So that's where they were, and then they moved from there.
I worked in Century City was the interim one, and then they moved to Sepulveda. Ultimately.
Okay.
Right now I think Fox's or something
Did you edit at like New World's offices then?
What happened was that Richard Halsey had his own private editing suite up in the Hollywood Hills near Lake Hollywood, and so we could have multiple movies being cut there, which was always fun. Like I say, there was a Paul Mazursky movie being done there, and there was Body Rock being done over here.
A little bit of a
that's the same. They're the same. They're pretty much the same films. The same films.
And my editing bench had Richard would always leave his Academy Award on the shelf above me. So anytime I was cranking film, it started to wobble. I was like worried I was going to get clobbered by the Academy Award. Because he didn't think much of it. He just kind of put it on the shelf. And, you know, it was just, he was a sweet guy. And I learned more about what editing was from Richard Halsey than anybody I ever worked with. Because Richard would go off. I would get the footage ready, and we would all go to Deluxe or whatever studio company it was doing the dailies, and we would watch the footage together. And my job was to make sure that all the notes were clear and whatever the circle takes were and all that. And then I would think in my naivete that Richard would be in there first thing in the morning cutting the scene. And that's not at all what happened. The next morning, I would show up with the new dailies, and Richard would saunter in about, 11 or 12 from the tennis court. And then without a word, Richard would go right to the editing, the chem, and start cutting up a storm. And I realized at that point that editing isn't about the equipment. It isn't about the machinery. It isn't about sitting there and trying to figure out where to cut. The editing is all up here. It's storytelling. And what he was doing while he was playing tennis was forming the scene based on the footage he saw the night before. And that was a huge revelation to me. So when I saw that, I realized, okay, editing is storytelling. Yeah. And for me, that was one of the biggest lessons I ever had that really helped my screenwriting. Was understanding that editing was the final version of television. Right. And prior to that, you're in the script stage and you're trying to shoot it and find the movie. But when you're editing, it's really telling the story for the last time. And Halsey was such a huge influence. I did Body Rock with him and took it through the end. And then I went off and did Return of the Living Dead, the first one, as the second assistant editor. Mm-hmm. And I worked with Bob Gordon in that case. And we were there doing Return of the Living Dead out in the valley at this warehouse where we were shooting the movie and we were editing right across the hall from it. So that was actually Hemdale. Orion ultimately released that movie. So this was... At that time, Return, the original one was, so I kind of got into this editing groove and I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. I like it. I'm learning an immense amount. And then I left Return of the Living Dead because I got a call from Lorenzo and Halsey that said, would you come be the first assistant? Now, this is a big deal. So I got a call to come do what's called first assistant on Girls Just Want to Have Fun. So go ahead.
On just a couple of questions on Body Rock, though. Was Lorenzo Lamas honestly a good dancer, or did you have to cut around it?
I thought they pulled it off quite well. I'm not sure he was, super, super light on his feet. But you can do amazing things in the editing room.
That's right. And that my favorite sequence of that is when all of a sudden Lorenzo's walking down the street and just starts talking to the camera and just goes in different angles and just starts talking straight to the camera, which is, I think, the only time in the whole film the fourth wall is broken. Yeah. It doesn't get broken at any other time, but he just suddenly starts saying like one-liners basically to the camera. And it's... Yeah. A really amazing sequence.
Well, the interesting thing about that movie was, if you put yourself back in a time capsule, you'll notice that around that same time, Canon Films was doing movies like Break Dancer 2 and
Breakin'. There was also
Breakin' Boogaloo and
Breakin' 2, and then there was Beat Street, I think, coming out, and they also done Rappin'. So it was and this was all in 84, so it all Body Rock sort of came after.
That was their late attempt to cash in on what Canon had done very successfully, and then so that was really what Body Rock was, and to me, it was my first job at New World. I was just in awe of the editors I was working with, and I had just a great experience there. But like I say, did you have other questions about
that? No. I wonder though if you kind of answered it, because I was wondering if like New World was trying to like press you at all in the, during the edit to be like, we got to hurry this up and get this thing out.
Absolutely. They were. Okay. It was definitely about getting it out into the marketplace, because Canon really, they hit a home run by forcing that thing out in record time. Mm-hmm. And
they were trying to get Break-In out before Beat Street came out.
Yeah.
And a real Corman-esque move, like trying to just beat, you know, somebody who they hear is making a breakdancing movie. So they hurry their breakdancing movie so they can get that out first. And then it's a huge sex, and then they make a sequel. So, and Body Rock's also trying to get in on that as well. Yeah, so, yeah.
And I remember as a kid, there were Break-In people and Beat Street people, and you had to pick a side.
Yeah, that's right.
I was a Beat Street person myself. Oh, so,
wow. Yeah, this is, I don't know how that we were in the same household, because I was a Break-In person.
No, we didn't talk much back then.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We were, yeah, back in 84, we were, when we were children, we were real odds. but yeah, you're saying then you get, so you didn't have a, you were really more working with the editor, not so much with New World, but you knew enough people in New World to be.
What happened was, is that when I was working on Return of Living Dead, then I got a call from the editors, Halsey and Lorenzo, and they said, hey, we're doing another New World movie. They were in charge of hiring their staff. So they said, we're going to move you up to first assistant editor, which is, you know, the guy who runs the facility, and come on back. And I was thrilled, because this was a dance movie. And that was the one, it was my big chance to start at the very beginning in pre-production and move all the way through post. And that's one of the reasons I left Torment, was because I started getting a lot of work through New World, mm-hmm. and this editing connection I had.
So you stopped using, when you're saying you left Torment, you stopped the edit. You were editing at the time, as we were talking in that episode. You were, it was being handed over to person to person, ending up with Scott.
Scott and Alexander sort of took over. Earl went off to do, I think, Decline of Western Civilization 2 or some other editing gig. And I went off and started working at New World in the editing department. Like I say, when Girls Just Want to Have Fun came in, I was so excited, because this was my first big show that was all, I got to begin it and go all the way through it. And that movie was a real fascinating adventure for me. First of all, you know, there from day one, cutting as we went along in production. Mm-hmm. I was going out to the location a lot, interfacing with Chuck and trying to remember our director's name now. Alan Metter was the director, that's right. And he endured incredible pressure from New World and so forth. And I felt a little bit bad for him, but he kind of bounced back, and he ended up doing that Richard Pryor movie afterward. And then he
did Back to School.
He did Back to School. Yes.
Was it Richard Pryor? Am I thinking?
And he did Moving with Richard. Yes. Yeah. But he did Back to School like pretty much right afterwards.
Yeah. Back to School and then Moving. That's what it was. But so Alan, Chuck, Richard, we all worked on the project. I started it with Lorenzo, and then a few weeks into the shoot, there's a guy named David Rollins. If you look him up, fascinating guy. He was the editor on Saturday Night Fever and the editor of Urban Cowboy. And I was thrilled to now become moved into a position where I would be working with him on a dance movie with this guy who had done these amazing dance movies. And I remember one of the things that was a really eye-opening is that I said, so what, tell me something about cutting Saturday Night Fever. And he says, well, I always looked for the choreographer in the crowd. And I go, what do you mean? He says the choreographer, we didn't have finished cuts for Saturday Night Fever. So we had basic tracks that the Bee Gees had sent. And but I knew the choreographer, I'd looked for him because he was always in the crowd clapping to the beat. And so I just made all my cuts whenever the beat went down and I cut to the next.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like,
wow,
this was like mind blowing. I thought there was some sort of feeling the moment, right, or something. No, I just looked for Otis clapping his hands.
Like a
and
click
that's
track,
when I knew to make the next cut. So that was eye opening. But David was an amazing guy. He was like an old cowboy. He had cowboy boots, and we all used to cut on, him especially would cut on moviolas, which were the old, viewing systems that chattered, and they were just, and he just had,
had a brake on it, and you had to hit the brake.
Had a brake on it, and we were cutting. Just for the record, I was the worst assistant editor in the history of Hollywood. I absolutely could not. The job was to keep track of everything, to be very organized. I'm not organized. I'm creative chaos. And every time Richard or David or Lorenzo would ask for an extension, right? That means after they cut a shot, they wanted to add stuff back.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I would panic because I can't find the trims because I don't know where they are.
Oh, right. Sure.
So I would immediately run to the phone and call Deluxe and I would order a reprint. So the reprint bill on all the New World movies was super high when I was an assistant because I was losing footage. I couldn't keep track of anything. I was terrible. I was a terrible assistant editor. But I made it up with my enthusiasm because I would be there as long as they needed it. Like Scott was saying on the other broadcast, if people were going to let you come in and make movies at that age, I was like, I'll do anything. I'll just be there just to learn something, and to get paid to do it was an amazing benefit.
When you do edit for this movie, or when you edit in general, do you go off or do you reference the script at all, or is it all just straight footage?
Absolutely, you reference the script. First of all, you're looking for circle takes, which it's called, the ones that the director on the set said, I like this performance in this take. So the first thing you do is you're printing just the circle takes.
Okay.
So you already know. And then the night before, we're watching footage with the director and they're throwing out, I want to use this for this. I want to do this for this. This comes for this part. I like this hat. And I'm the one taking all those notes, right? So those are the things that I translate to the first editor.
Okay.
Now, on Girls Just Want to Have Fun, I was given scenes to cut, which is very fun.
Because, you know,
what they do is they say, okay, you know, you've earned this place. So now here's your scene. You can cut in Girls Just Want to Have Fun. So that was a real fun thing to do. On that movie, we also, because I took it from day one of shooting all the way through post, we also did a big pickup. Do you remember the dance concert, the big dance competition the end?
Yeah. Of course.
We went back and for a whole couple days, we went back to that park and we reshot. And I had to bring my moviola down to the set, the back of a truck. So we were watching what we were adding to. So it was a very
interactive
thing where we were looking at footage and then going and making sure that we.
So this is the big audition that's out in the middle of the park. It's that one, not the ending. Okay. Wow. Yes.
And we did the whole thing out there. And so I was on the set for all of that. And I really just got a kick out of the whole experience. I remember having lunch with Sarah Jessica Parker and that gang. And I'll never forget this. We were sitting there talking and I was like, oh God, you know, the whole money side of this industry, I just don't, you know, I just am more interested in doing my creative side. And she just turned to me and said, don't be an idiot. You know, be aware of the business side of this industry, because if not, you're never going to be put in that position of being able to call the shots. And that stuck with me. And I thought, wow, she kind of admonished me. And I thought that was a really cool thing for her to say to me. She probably has no memory of this at all, because it was just some passing comment as we were eating lunch. But it really, it made an impression on me that somebody like her, who went on to take control of her career, and what she was saying to me was, don't just be a creative type that just does the will of others. Take control of your career and really make the decisions that can steer it one way or the other. And that was a big moment. I mean, it made an impression on me. Like I say, she probably had no memory of it. But that was just one of those things that happened on that movie with me that I'll always remember. But anyway, we shot all this stuff. We brought it to the editing room. And I'll remember David calling it captured war footage. He says, I've just got to try to find the movie in all, you know, we had A, B, and C cameras. And by God, if he didn't do it, you know, he kept, it wasn't the spectacle that he pursued. It was the emotional story connections that he pursued. What does this character feel about this moment when Sarah Jessica Parker is doing her dance? What does this character feel about this character doing the dance? And that was another revelation, is that with all this understanding of what I thought I was going to learn about how to cut dance, it was nothing more than basic storytelling. Understanding that you've got all this wonderful dance footage, that's great, but what's going to keep the audience engaged is what the each character, what do they want? What are they, how are they relating to the other one? So he'll cut to silent reactions constantly, keep us alive in that story. And that was really interesting to me. It really made an impression. David Rollins, a great editor, ended up doing a bunch of, you know, industry or audience reaction screenings that I would have to run with the print of the film. It was my job to take the print to the theater. One in Santa Monica, and I'll never forget, Chuck Russell said, John, this movie is done. Don't fumble it on the 1 yard line. I'm going, okay. And then I had images of me dropping the footage on, you know, right before the theater. I don't know what that 1 yard line metaphor was.
But, oh my goodness.
I was very nervous about those preview screenings, and the movie I thought turned out okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? It hit, I think, a lot of, you know, when we did our episode on it, we had a guest on there who she grew up and loved this movie. This Which was just the girls just want to have fun. She'd watch this and
she wasn't involved in it though.
No. Oh. We did talk to Janice Hirsch, who rewrote the script, is uncredited.
Wrote that script, man. That's her. Yeah. That's how what's her name became involved.
Sarah Jessica Parker, right.
Became involved because of her. And that was the script that we shot. Her name was on that script when I did the editing.
That's interesting, because she talked about how she's now, I think, part of like the WGA or whatever, but she didn't get credit for it. It's credited to someone else. But she wrote the script, and she told us a lot about rewriting the script as it went. And it was like, you know, so that's why I asked about the script, because I was like, I was wondering, did they have an assembled script? But I have to imagine that they just took those pages and put them all together.
Well, no, she was on the script that I have somewhere around here as credited on the title page. So she had done a show called Square Pegs, I think.
Right, yeah.
Jessica Parker. Mm-hmm. And then that's how she got involved in the movie, which she's so perfectly cast in that movie. And Helen Hunt is so good. And we finished that movie. I worked with Tommy Newman, the music composer. He was really great. He's gone on to do an amazing amount of stuff. And we did all the sound mixing at Rider Sounds and Sound in Hollywood. And it came out, and I was thinking, this is a pretty cool movie. It actually works, I think, altogether. It's funny. I cut the sequence when Sarah Jessica's boyfriend calls and Shannon Doherty interrupts and the phone gets ripped out of the hand. I don't know if you remember that sequence.
Yeah, you bet.
Of course.
That was the sequence I got to cut that they gave me.
Cool.
Which was fun. Yeah. So you have your little moment there.
That's great.
It was great. It was such a great, fun time.
And you had interaction with Chuck Russell, who I, you know, it's interesting to me that that's how he even gets started. Sort of like he did behind the scenes stuff. But at this point, I know he'd worked with Frank Darabont. They met doing Hell Night, which is a Tom DeSimone movie from the early 80s. And then he gets somehow to start producing movies for New World. And I know he wants to be a director. That's, of course, what he eventually goes on to do. So it's interesting that phase of his career there sort of gets.
Yeah,
New World gets a little bad taste of him there.
Yeah, no, it was a great group. Like I said, Rachel Talalay was our accountant. She went on to do Tank Girl. Frank Darabont was a production assistant. I'd always see him in the production office writing on his K-Pro, working on The Blob with Chuck. And Chuck Russell's
what did Frank ever do? God, yeah. What happened to Frank really Darabont? You know, really just disappeared off them.
they're just shirking it. but we were kind of like compadres because he was an assistant to Chuck and I was an assistant to the editing room. So years later, I was at a Writers Guild Award and Darabont came up and said, oh, yeah, you did that Return Living Dead 3 movie, right? The one with the girl. I said, yeah. He says, oh, that was good. So that was the last I ever heard from him.
Did he remember your days doing
things that someone could say to you as the first time you talked to him?
Yeah. But he did not remember your girls just want to have fun days or?
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course.
Okay.
Yeah. No, we, you know, that movie, I ended up taking all the way through post. We did the final mix at 20th Century Fox. Now, that means where you're putting all the music together and the sound effects.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a time in which 20th Century Fox, like New World, would go rent whatever facility they could get to mix the movie. And at that point, I got that mixed up. Body Rock was done at Fox. Body Rock was done at Fox. And Girls, I think, was done at Rider Sound. But anyway, I remember working all nights at 20th Century Fox lot, and we ended up stealing the golf carts at night. We drive around going over bumps and flying around. And then one of them crashed and died. And I just ran back and never told anybody until this moment.
Drive around in all those sets and stuff that they have down there?
Yeah. Drive around. Yeah.
Cause they got a big bunch of like sets just set up that are just there. You could just, that's fun.
I think that was Body Rock though. But on Girls, we were at Rider Sound. And so I finished all the way through post-production on Girls Just Want to Have Fun. I had met my girlfriend, who is now my wife. And she says, it's my birthday. What are we doing? I said, well, I've got to go mix the end credits for Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Do you want to come on? And she's like, I don't know what that means, but sure. All night watching the credits go up and then the music would be, and it was a nightmare. I feel bad about it to this day. I subject.
Wow.
But anyway, so that was a great experience at New World.
Did it lead to anything else or did it? I mean, I know you did one, you also did one more, but did Girls Just Want to Have a Fun immediately lead to the stuff or did you, was there other? Okay.
It did. No, what happened was that during this end phase of Girls Just Want to Have Fun, I started hearing a percolation of a movie called The Stuff with Larry Cohen. And they said, John, we have to recut this movie called The Stuff. Do you want to be involved? And of course, I said, absolutely, I'd be involved. So what happened on that movie was Larry had finished that movie through to what's called an answer print. And an answer print is where it looks like the final version of the movie, where the mix of the sound is put on the edge of the film. Everything is married together. Everything is color timed. Everything's finished, supposedly finished, right? So New World acquires this movie, The Stuff. And they say, we're going to recut it. It needs work in the editing room. And we say, okay, yeah, I'm on, whatever you need. So Lorenzo and I ended up being the two people who really recut that movie with Larry. And what happened was I got an answer print, and then I had to break it down again. I had to break out all the reels into the original 10-minute reels, recode it with the sound. So we had what's called dual system. So you had sound on one film reel and picture on the other, so you could actually do editing. Mm-hmm. And so we took that answer print, broke it back down, separated the sound from it, and we recut the movie. And we ended up going from the beginning to the end. It was a bunch of notes that we were following from New World. And then what happened was Larry was there the whole time. And he was such a team player, man. That guy was such a fun guy to hang out with. We ended up finishing the recut, which he totally approved of. It was all done with his supervision and his blessing. And we ended up recutting it at Rider Sound again. And during the mix, Larry would constantly be pitching new movies. So it was this weird situation where they had a little putting green down on the front beneath the stage. So when you were between reels editing, you could go down and practice your putting. And I'll never forget, time after time, Larry would be down there putting and he'd go, all right, imagine this. And then he would launch into a whole pitch of a movie. And damned if those pitches weren't really good. It was like, he had this knack mm-hmm. of coming up with high concepts, mm-hmm. like phone booth, cell phone, whatever it was.
Right, right. He'd
come up with these high concept ideas and rattle off a pitch. And I'm like, wow, this guy's insane, but he's really got a knack for commercial,
his concept. His movies are so good, and it's amazing he pulls off what he pulls off with the budgets that he ends up getting in, like not just The Stuff, but even Q. How does he pull off Q?
Questacoddle.
That's right. So I mean, unbelievable what he's able to pull off.
I'll give you a little secret. In The Power, the name of the little creature, the little statue, is Destacottle.
Yep, that's right.
In honor of Larry Cohen.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
That is awesome.
So when you're getting notes, do you remember any of the notes that New World gave you about The Stuff? They clearly wanted to do it with Larry Cohen on board. They weren't trying to take it away from him.
No. He was completely on board. It might have had something to do with the running length. So it's about shortening and getting the story going quicker.
Okay.
But aside from that, I don't really remember what the broad notes were. We did work very closely with Larry. It wasn't like we were somehow taking the movie away from him. He was all on board with it. He would give feedback and everything on all the cuts we made. Like I say, he was at the final mix when we remixed the sound and everything. The only thing we didn't do was redo the credits because it would have been too much money at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it would only have been to throw our names on the end, like additional
right.
something.
Right. Right.
So we never messed with that, but it was really his movie and he really, shepherded it through. And it was all very, from my point of view, it was a very friendly kind of experience. But I thought he was great. I thought Larry Cohen was one of a kind and a real, product of his, his creative essence. I mean, this guy just drove toward these ideas that he always a little bit more than he could afford, but somehow he could get these great actors involved and
Michael Moriarty and many of them. Speaking of Moriarty, he improvised a lot on that movie. Was that difficult to cut around, or it at that point maybe Larry had kind of dealt with a lot of those?
Larry had dealt with all that on the previous version, so by the time we came in, we had, like I say, that what he was his finished, quote unquote, finished version. And then we went in and recut that. Mm-hmm. So we moved, I think we moved some of the commercials. They would have commercials for the stuff.
Right, right.
We maybe moved those around a little bit. We did a lot of, extraction of things that
I think there was a few commercials that didn't make the final cut, I believe.
We took those out.
And unfortunately, are lost. Larry says, he said at least in the featurette that's on the Blu-ray, he said that he doesn't have those anymore. So he doesn't know where the. I mean, he made a bunch of them. He said there's some that didn't get in, and they're lost. So
yeah. I should have kept better track, but I'm a shitty person.
They're all like in a bin. They're all in this box. Just all of them.
Same place that I lose all my trims in.
Right. There's Body Rock stuff in here. Yeah. There's like, it's all sorts of stuff.
Girls just want to have fun. Body Rock.
Socks. It's just it's really.
Right. Somebody's half of somebody's lunch. This is just tons of stuff in here. Did he tell you any of his marketing ideas that he had for the stuff while you're editing it?
I didn't hear about that I can recall, but
because he apparently wanted New World to sell the stuff and make a product and sell it in stores prior to the movie being advertised.
I do not doubt that on any level. That's exactly what Larry would have done.
And I think that he just said the studio. He did, so he doesn't say New World, but he said the studio felt it would be a legal liability that they didn't want to step into, right? But
it would have been it would have been very expensive. Expensive.
Sure. Because then you have to create a whole
now. Yeah. Because you could just spin up like an e-commerce site and try to sell something like that, but getting it in stores, that would have been tough.
That was a different expensive.
Yeah, yeah. And do you know what New World, like, once you guys brought it to them, how did they react to the finished cut that you worked on?
There were never any, there was no pushback. There was no controversy that I remembered on any level with that movie. It was, we brought the running time down. As you said, we did lose some of the commercials. I think we moved some of them earlier. But other than that, it was a very harmonious thing, and there was never any issue with it. And it was kind of odd for me because I would have thought when I first got involved with it, I thought, oh shoot, this director's in love with this picture and he's locked it. And it's, but Larry wasn't like that. He was a team player, he would go out and get involved, roll up his sleeves and say, okay, let's make this happen. He was a very, very wonderful, resilient kind of guy that I really enjoyed hanging out with the little I did.
Yeah, because I know Larry had spoken a little bit about how New World was a little disappointed because they were anticipating, I'm not sure what they were anticipating, but I think they wanted more of a horror film than what the stuff turned out to be. Which, I mean, I get why they might anticipate that, but I also feel like, have you not seen any of Larry Cohen's previous films?
Yeah, I know. That's an interesting comment. Did you guys interview Larry?
Oh no. No, I wish we had. He's passed on, so we won't have that opportunity, but would have loved to have been able to. I just love his movies.
I'm telling you, he would have done it in a heartbeat. He loved the spotlight. He loved being able to talk and to carry on in front of an audience. He loved it. He absolutely loved it.
And I guess if there's somebody who can make not just one but three Killer Baby movies and make it still seem like, I mean, those are, you know, have a lot of horror elements to it, especially the first two. Maybe I guess they were thinking of that, but I'm like, if you look at a lot of his other movies, and New World was at least the Corman era, even they were, you know, had released God Told Me To, and I think New World Video released Bone, one of his earlier films as well. So like, they're familiar with his work, but I guess they wanted more horror than I think they were anticipating.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I saw that the tone is very odd with the stuff because it almost feels like social satire.
Mm-hmm.
and it's not really horror. It kind of reminded me a little of The Hidden a little bit, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So that kind of stuff. And so when I saw it, that's the vibe I got, was it's not super intense horror. It's kind of fun horror, you know.
I felt like if Larry Cohen made exploitation movies like so well, and he did it so well and so almost subversively that it people didn't would forget that this is what you're sort of watching, an exploitation film, you know. Right. Like you wouldn't remember it, you wouldn't think of it, you know. And that stuff certainly fits into that because it's so of his stuff in the 70s, but it's just, and it's such a, you know, consumerism you know, satire, and I don't think they knew where they were getting. And it's funny to me because then, as we sort of mentioned in our previous conversation, that they had purchased the rights to The Blob after they had put out the stuff. And I wondered if, did they do that just because they were thinking, well, now let's get the real horror version of the stuff, because they wanted something nastier. Of course, they end up selling the rights and they don't end up making the movie, but I wondered if that was what they did.
Hard to say. You should get Chuck in here, or
I know.
That's Frank.
That's right. Got to get. Yeah, Frank's not doing much. We got to dial him up and see if he can.
Hey man, you guys got Scott Alexander.
Yeah, right?
I know. Well, we were after Daniel Waters. Daniel also was like, you got to talk to Scott about, you know, Torment. So, that it was great being able to talk with everybody, all you guys, really. It's been amazing that we've been able to talk with you guys.
It's been a fun time.
Another question. Were there any other New World movies that you were either asked to come back and work on and you didn't get a chance to, or weren't available to, that maybe you could have?
That's a really good question. The answer is yes, 100% there was, I'm sure. But at that point, I had sold a script to Warner Brothers, and I left my editing days behind me. I became a writer-producer, and then ultimately a writer-director. That was a big decision in my life, because I really enjoyed editing. And the more I got to actual editing rather than assistant editing, where I didn't have to worry about finding trims, the more I enjoyed it, because it was pure storytelling, you know.
Yeah.
But at that point, I ended up, The Kindred came out.
Yep.
In 86 or 87, I can't.
87, I believe.
87. And then once you have a screenplay credit, like I did on that movie, Scott Alexander, I had an agent before then. That did the movie I had at Warner Brothers as a screenwriter. That was with the people who did Torment.
Right. The one with Sam and John that you guys worked on for.
We had In Development Hell. And then after that, I sort of went my own way. And Scott Alexander called me up one afternoon and said, hey, my agent's assistant is going to be opening his own shingle at this famous old agency. Are you interested in joining? And I said, oh, okay. And I went in, and so Scott got me my first solo agent, actually, which is the power of working with friends that you know for so long.
Right.
And Sandy Weinberg was his name, and the name of the agency was a guy who was 100 years old. This is a weird story. I'll address briefly, but if you ever want to find out, look up a guy named H.N. Swanson. Okay. The book is called Sprinkled with Ruby Dust. Okay.
Looking it up.
I'm telling you, he's Elmore Leonard's agent. He was Gerald's agent. He was F. Scott Fitzgerald, William Faulkner, Raymond Chandler, James Cain, Elmore Leonard. He was their agent in the golden era of Hollywood.
Wow. And
I was actually a client of his, which is this crazy turn of events in my career. But because of Scott, this young guy started working for H.N. Swanson. And Swanson wrote this dedication to me his book that says, red shoes travel faster.
Wow.
He thought that writers were magical in some way.
Wow.
He was literally 100 years old when I joined the agency, and I had to go pitch him an idea. And he had a cigar, and he's this old guy behind a desk. And I started pitch. I was very nervous because I'm pitching to the guy who is William Faulkner's.
F. Scott Fitzgerald. I mean, my Lord.
Yes. And he started telling me, he says, let me tell you a story, John. He says, this guy I had, he came up with this book called East Egg. And I said, East Egg? What's East Egg? East Egg's nothing. The Great Gatsby. That's what you got to call this book. And so he made him call East Egg Great Gatsby. That's his big claim to fame.
Wow.
And so now I had to pitch to this guy, H.N. Swanson. And I'm trembling in my boots, but his wife was really sweet. And she came in and told him to knock down his pedestal a little bit and said, just listen to the kid's pitch. But I did. I had to pitch to H.N. Swanson, and he liked the story that I was pitching. And that was my first solo agent, was this guy, H.N. Swanson, if you look back on I always have this theory that when you look back on Hollywood, the way we look back on other histories, like the first 100 years, that's nothing. That's a blip. Right.
Right.
So I'll be lumped in with these other people that he represented. And in the first 100 years of Hollywood, these were the people who were there. And then we move on. And but I had no contact, obviously, with any of those brilliant writers.
Sure.
But
sure.
That was all Scott. Scott set me up, and I got this agent from H.N. Swanson, and one of those weird connections to old Hollywood. Mm-hmm.
Did you get anything, did you get any gig from that?
Yeah, no, I was Sandy's client for a while, and I ended up working quite a bit. Sandy was the agent that got me Return 3, got me set up with a bunch of stuff. And then, because I went on with Innovative Artists, and I, which was another agency, that Sandy moved to,
but
it was this weird thing where we all started off together, Scott and all these people that were in those early days, and then you keep in touch with them, and they're like extended family. And then somebody needs an agent, a client, and so he recommends me, and it was a wonderful time. It was a lot of fun.
So you decide to leave editing behind, become a writer, but it's at some point you also wanted to not just write but direct, right?
Yeah, that brings us to the infamous Sizzix Road,
right behind you.
Have you heard of it, Zizek's Road at all?
Yeah, Tom Sizemore, right? And
Katherine Heigl.
Like an early, isn't it an early role from Katherine Heigl?
Do you know the story of this movie?
A little bit, yeah.
When you Google this movie, what comes up?
I'll Google it in real time.
Research.
Do it in real time, and we're going to have fun with your audience tonight. What does Entertainment Weekly say about it?
Why did Zizek's Road make $30 is what Google tells me. Is that what you're looking for?
The lowest grossing movie in U.S. box office history.
Wow.
Wow. Well,
do you want to hear the story?
Yeah, I mean, yes, of course. Yes. What happened?
You guys have stumbled onto gold. So what happened? And you can read all about this in Entertainment Weekly. What happened was I pitched this idea. And I told the producer, "Yeah, I'll sell you this thriller, but I want to direct it." First movie I produced, wrote, and directed. And they said, "Okay, yeah," but it was a long pause before they said that. So I was like nervous. Oh my God, I've overstepped my bounds. Mm. Said, "Yeah, you can direct this movie." I said, "Oh, great." So I ended up directing this movie. We had a different actress originally in the part. She was in American Beauty. Trying to remember her name. Thora Birch. Thora Birch was originally going to play the part in Zizek's Road. So she has a father who is her manager. And he is an adult film star in his past. And now he is managing her. And she would love this script. The script was terrific. It had lots of twists and turns. Of course, I'm the director writer. I thought it was great. And people really responded to it. And her manager father ultimately said, "No, there's not a big enough name in this movie for her to do the movie." So Thora Birch left the movie at the last minute, and we're scrambling around. And Katherine Heigl had been after this movie from day one. She really responded to the material, liked the script. It's a terrific part for a female lead. And you get to play multiple different personalities. And she really liked it and pursued it. And we ended up casting her. And I shot the movie. I directed it. It was in Mojave Desert. We made the movie. And we had a deal with Regent Entertainment. And Regent Entertainment said, "Well, we shot the movie under a theatrical, low-budget theatrical agreement with SAG. So that means you have to show it in a theater to qualify for this contract." So yeah. Regent Entertainment said, "Oh, we have theaters in Texas. We'll show the movie, no problem." So they put a DVD. Here, I even have one. I use it as a coaster here.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
That's my coaster. They put a DVD in the theater in Texas, and they didn't advertise. It was just so we could qualify for a theatrical run for SAG. Well, turns out our makeup artist lived in that area, looked at the paper and says, "Oh, the movie I worked on is there. I'm going to go see it." So they went to see it. It only was during matinees. They didn't even have it at night. She shows up, buys a ticket with her friend, ends up watching the movie, and the guy at the box office reports this gross. So they call in for the U.S. grosses, and suddenly $30 pops up for Zizek's Road. Now, immediately, I think it was Dread Central or one of those really hip horror sites, picks up on this story and says, "The lowest grossing movie in U.S. box office history is Zizek's Road, blah, 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 blah." And this just becomes a big internet sensation. Next thing you know, Variety picks it up and does a story on Zizek's Road. Now, the original website gets mad at Variety because they didn't give him credit for finding the story. Yeah. So now there's a big fight on the internet. I am blissfully unaware up in Central California doing my wine stuff. I get a call from my editor from New York, and he says, John, have you read Time Magazine? I go, what are you talking about? He says, Zizek's is in there as the lowest grossing movie of box office history. I go, what? Time Magazine? Are you insane? Turns out this thing took off like a, because it's such a great headline, right?
Yeah.
The lowest grossing movie of all time is Zizek's Road. First of all, you can't pronounce the movie. It's a weird movie. It's quirky. People love this idea, and it had a life of its own. And I'm like, if you read the Entertainment Weekly article, Scott and Larry are saying, John, go with this. Go with this. You can ride this thing. This is great. You know, own it. I said, I don't know. Entertainment Weekly wants to do a story on it. I'm not sure. No, you guys should. You should definitely do it. And I'm like, okay. So I do this Entertainment Weekly article, and I set the record straight. And it becomes, hopefully, thankfully, the sort of the official record of what happened, which was it was a qualifying screening that got reported.
Yeah. But
nonetheless, this movie lives to tell the tale of the lowest grossing movie in U.S. box office.
Amazing.
And to this day, I am desperate to try to get a picture of me and Avatar guy.
James Cameron?
James Cameron together in one picture where it's the biggest gross up and the lowest. anyway,
that amazing story.
Did it do okay once it went out on?
Well, what happened was we did really well internationally because, and we got a what do you call Redbox release in the U.S. So it went out. We made plenty of money. It wasn't an issue, but it was the story that
sure.
Is the crazy, you know, thing about Zizek's Road. And I got approached by Fortune magazine on the 10-year anniversary saying, hey, would you want to come on the Fortune magazine and tell us about Zizek's? What's going on with your career? And I'm like, actually, anyone in the film industry understands exactly what it was. So I went on and did my movie, this one, Hellgate, with William Hurt and Cary Elwes, after that movie. So it didn't really, I did two movies after that. So it didn't really break my stride on directing, but it was
sure.
One of those weird, fun anecdotes.
That's amazing.
You know, a feather in your cap is, it doesn't, you know, it's a feather. You know what I mean? And it's, you know, it's and there's other feathers there too, but that's one in there too. And
lowest grossing box office film in U.S. history. That's me. And my last name's Penny. So that's what Scott and Larry said. They said, just say, what do you expect from a guy whose last name is Penny? They're always looking for the humor and everything, which I
know. Yeah, that's so great. That's so great. And you're still working to this day. You still have projects going. As you were saying, you got a potential Society remake.
Yeah,
sequel. Pardon me.
The Society. I've got a novel coming out in May. Two other novels. One called Truck Stop, and the other one's called Killing Time. Killing Time just came out as an Audible, which you guys should check out.
Yeah, 100%. Nice.
They're really fun stories that I love telling. They're genre stuff, sort of Stephen King-ish. The new one coming out in May, it's released by Encyclopocalypse Publications, which is Mark Brown, who used to work for Hellgate. What the hell is it? Not Hellgate. It's Hellraiser. The author.
Peter Eckens, you mean? Or Clive Barker?
Hi, Barker. So, yeah. Mark, you should have Mark on your podcast. Mark, although it's not New World, Mark worked for Clive Barker for years and then went off and created this new publishing entity called Encyclopocalypse Publishing. And yes, Peter Atkins is on there.
Mm-hmm.
He's a friend. We do book signings together. So I have a new book coming out in May called It Comes Back, which is sort of an homage to a lot of things that I hold dear. So I also teach writing and directing at the Los Angeles Film School. I'm an adjunct professor there. And I can't tell you how many times, when I first started there, people would come up and say, oh, your movie, here, will you sign this, Return 3 movie or Kindred? Mm-hmm. And I'd say, oh, great. And now I get, that was one of my dad's favorite movies. I'm like moving on now. Next, it's up to you guys to make the new movies. I don't know.
Well, this was awesome. Thank you so much, John, for your time and for talking with us. This was another great, we love talking to people such as yourself that had such an amazing career and all the time at New World. I'm so glad that it helped guide you and Sarah Jessica Parker helped move your career along.
I had to take responsibility for my own finances. Yes,
yeah.
She was.
Yeah. You should have sent her that, that Zizek's Road box office and said, look, I did it.
I took her advice.
Yeah.
Now I'm a disaster. Thank you, Sarah. Or thank you for setting me right.
But thank you again for talking with us. This was amazing. We really appreciate your time so much.
Hey, anytime, guys. Anytime. I love talking about this kind of stuff. So if you ever find yourself in another iteration that you want to hear from me, I'm totally at your disposal.
Please, awesome. Thank you, John. That means the world to us. Thank you very much. And everybody, check out John's book coming out in May.
Yes.
It Comes Back. Check that out. We'll be excited to check that out. So thank you again, John, for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Bye, John.
Bye.
Wow.